Well, welcome to the session on health and digital earth. I'm glad that you've chosen this session with so many other choices to make in these parallel sessions. And the format will be that we'll have five speakers, including myself, make our remarks. But we're going to save questions for a group question and answer period at the end with all the speakers together. So let me get started. Empowering communities for health, global change, technology, communication, and education. And the purpose of my talk is really to serve as an introduction to the cross-cutting themes that you will see in the remainder of the talks and think about ways in which the different aspects or perspectives that people offer, think about the ways in which they tie together. Is this it? Okay. So here are the key themes. Global change in health. We've been hearing already a lot at this meeting about various aspects of global change. We haven't been hearing too much about how they relate to emerging health problems, and that's really one of the underlying themes of this session. A second theme, which we have heard a tremendous amount about, is information technology. There's a revolution in many aspects. And again, the focus of this session, being the only one on health, is connecting the theme of digital earth to address health needs. And the third aspect, I've lumped communication and education to broadly support the idea of engaging a larger audience in new ways of thinking about these issues. Obviously, each one of these topics has a lot of different pieces to it, and I'm only going to give a few highlights to get you thinking about these themes and to sensitize you to be looking for them throughout the session. Okay, the first theme on global change and health, this is a diagram from a book I edited on ecosystem change and public health, which really pulls together the themes that we're talking about on global change. In the outer part of the circle, what you can see is on the top, decline of natural resources, air. We've heard a lot about climate, water, land, energy. Going around the circle, you can see economic development issues, industrialization and agricultural development, and further going around, you can see population growth, issues of urbanization, migration, which we've heard a lot about. And public health is affected by all of these, and it also, in turn, does affect them. But we're going to focus on first describing some of really reprising some of the themes that we've been hearing about population development and natural resources. And then, again, the purpose of this session will then say, okay, that's happening, and what are some of the health implications of that? So I'm going to go through this rather quickly because we have already been hearing a lot about this at this meeting. Human population growth in the 20th century was unprecedented change from less than 2 billion to over 6 billion in just one century, and that's we currently have unprecedented levels of human population in the world. Urbanization, this is the year that was sort of projected where the urban population equals the rural population globally, and megacities will be more numerous and larger, and I think the bottom bullet is perhaps the one to really think about, is that it's projected that most of the population growth in the next 50 years will be cities in poor countries with huge health implications. There's been a lot of migration. We tend to focus on the migration into the United States and developed world, but there's a lot of migration going along among developing countries. Uneven population growth, this even came up today, I think, in terms of the age structure. Most industrial countries, the trend is one of slower negative growth and an aging population. Less developed countries are quite young on average. There's tremendous divide in terms of economics. We have, over the 20th century, tremendous growth in domestic product, and yet we have, 1.2 billion in absolute poverty. The trend of globalization, it has not been really sufficiently pointed out that this trend has really been going on for centuries. And starting, well, even further back, but certainly the Industrial Revolution and the trends of globalization have been going on. And that's why making the changes that people are asking about really are fundamental, because society has been structured along this globalization and along the use of fossil fuels for centuries now. And carbon dioxide has been rising. And this is an example of deforestation. Energy resources, we heard a lot about energy resources the first day, and I won't dwell on that, except that some of these changes that are projected may even be happening faster than originally thought. And food and water. Okay, I want to move quickly through this, and a lot of, again, because we've been hearing a lot about this already, environmental treaties, global ones to address various issues from climate change to ozone pollutants. Now, if you start looking at what are the health outcomes, one dimension, and we'll be hearing more about this, is emerging infectious diseases, and population globalization and environmental change are key factors in the spread of infectious diseases that affect rich and poor countries. And when you take a look at the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on looking at health effects of global climate change, these are the bullets for the different health impacts that they're looking at. So you can see that even just the issue of climate change alone cuts across many, many aspects of health, heat waves, cold waves, also infectious diseases, air quality, and so forth. I'm not going to read the entire list. This is just to sensitize you to the idea that with all the huge global change issues that we've been hearing about in the last couple of days, there are health implications. And severe health implications of most of them. Okay, just very briefly on the information technology revolution, because this is something we have been hearing a lot about, and I'm going to pull some bullet points from this design guide for Earth System Science Education that I've been working on with one of our speakers, Martin Ruzek. And Bob Harris has succinctly outlined the fact that there are five revolutions going on as part of the information technology revolution. There's access, there's interface and mobility. We've been hearing a lot about mobility, I think, today. Information retrieval, integration, collaboration. I think that's maybe the theme of this meeting that I hear emerging, and analysis and communication. So you see that the information technology is not just having a computer that runs faster. There's many aspects that it will facilitate. And in support of this philosophy of digital Earth, that any citizen of the planet should be able to freely access this world of information. And again, the focus of this session is how to use that information to take actions for health and sustainability of communities. Now, the last part, I'd like to just very briefly highlight some themes related to communication and education. Not to get at the details of those programs, you're going to be hearing some examples, but to think about what is it that we're really trying to do. We are trying to change people's behavior. And there's an interesting chapter that I'm going to cite here from Stephen Linder in a book about integrating public health into adaptation to climate change, about the kind of behavioral change that we would want to do and lessons learned from how difficult it is to do this in the public health arena. And so there's public health interventions can be military style sort of direct orders to community-based programming, but there's been mixed success, because changing people's behavior on a large scale is difficult. So here are some of the lessons learned is that you can look at this at, he outlines four different levels. There's obviously subgroups of this. You can start from a more individual approach with preventive medicine. It's a sort of doctor-patient relationship. You can expand somewhat from there into a web of social relationships, in terms of these, friends and family. And then you can kind of build out from there. And there's community health, participation, and community groups. I think a lot of what we were hearing this morning was about community approaches. And then one can even go further to upstream determinants, more societal factors, which might be social stratification, inequalities, but it could be other global environmental issues. So Linder's point is that to make the changes, it's not an either-or. You really have to approach this at multiple levels, and I think the talks that you'll hear will demonstrate that. And again, the importance of multiple approaches, different levels of intervention. And technical expertise is important, and I think one particularly important one is earth system science and health. But the public must be actively engaged. And the there is what he calls the paradox of preventive action, is when the disease prevention is successful, then people think the problem is solved. And then we cut the funding and so forth. And I'm sure all the health people here could think of many examples, but here's one that's very, has a nice illustration, is the distribution of the mosquito vector that transmits dengue and yellow fever. And there had been a campaign over the decades that culminated in 1970, and you can see that the mosquito had really been very restricted to a small part of the Americas. And then the problem was solved, right? You know, other priorities, cancer, heart disease, this was not considered such an issue. And over the years, the mosquito has spread, and in fact, it's even gotten worse than, or it's spread even further than it had originally. So that's a classic example, and I'm sure people here could cite other ones. Okay, so the future directions, I think one of the cross-cutting ideas of this is we want to have capacity, we want to have action, but we really want to think about what is it that we want to do. And I think that all of our different speakers can have a different perspective on this, and I think that they're all important, and how do we fit them together? And again, just to reprise, I see the themes that tie across all the different talks is issues of global change and health, information technology, and communication and education. So thank you very much. And we will move on to Milt. Milt Friend is the founding director of the National Center for Wildlife Health in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's now director emeritus. And he will be speaking from his notes.
Can I bend this cover down, or do you want this left up? Put it down, it won't bother anything. Thank you for coming. Excuse me, trying to get through this. I thank Joan for organizing a health session for this symposium. This has been a area of attention for me for close to 5 decades. My focus is wildlife, however, rather than human health, and my purpose of being at this symposium is to highlight the need for change in the way society addresses disease in free-ranging wildlife. This need has cross-cutting implications for humans, domestic animals, and wildlife health because of the ability of many pathogens to move between these different host populations. The importance of this need lies in the fact that infectious disease emergence and resurgence is a contemporary issue involving wildlife, domestic animals, and humans alike, yet the wildlife component is receiving little preemptive attention. Instead, there are two reoccurring themes associated with wildlife diseases. First, disease in wildlife is often viewed and reacted to as if it were a cause rather than an outcome. As a result, responses, when they occur, typically address symptoms rather than cause. Second, the primary drivers of wildlife disease are often anthropogenic rather than biological factors. Failure to appropriately address disease in wildlife populations undermines efforts to conserve biodiversity and has major ramifications for human health and well-being, including economics. Thus, my comments initiate conversation about three major changes I seek as outcomes. First, I would like to see current apathy and crisis response to wildlife disease events replaced by preemptive approaches for disease management that benefit wildlife and society alike. Second, I would like to see wildlife health considerations fully integrated within environmental education programs, habitat acquisition decisions, and in land use planning processes. And third, I would like to see the rhetoric about, quote, one environment, one health, end of quote, transformed into actions that are consistent with the context for this concept. Clearly, the changes I seek involve adjustments in human perceptions and behaviors towards wildlife disease. These changes are needed both within the scientific community and society in general. Digital Earth, from my perspective, provides an important venue for communicating this need through information packaging and presentation that allows education to stimulate innovation for action. Media reports of infectious disease events involving animals have become so common as to occur almost daily. Many of these events have a wildlife component and are of primary concern because of real and/or perceived economic and/or human health implications. An unprecedented variety of disease agents and animal species are involved, especially for wildlife. Nevertheless, numerous individuals erroneously conclude that much of what is cited as evidence for an increasing problem of infectious disease emergence is largely an artifact of advances in information technology that facilitates rapid dissemination and broad access to reports of disease events. Regardless of that viewpoint, infectious disease emergence is a well-documented global issue involving increasing occurrences of disease transfers between species and the resurgence of diseases previously considered conquered. Factors associated with these events are such that for the foreseeable future, society is likely to be confronted with increasing infectious disease challenges. The biological and social and economic costs to be incurred from disease emergence are closely associated with our understanding of disease ecology and how that understanding is preemptively considered and applied. Knowledge deficiencies in disease ecology are not limited to recently emerged diseases or those typically endemic to areas outside the mainstream of human habitation. And what I mean by knowledge deficiencies, I mean general knowledge. We have a lot of scientific knowledge. In general, there is inadequate understanding of the role of wildlife in the ecology of many disease agents that infect multiple species. A major reason for this deficiency is traditional disparate approaches to human, domestic animal, and wildlife health. Unlike human and domestic animal disease programs, there is no government infrastructure for implementing and sustaining integrated long-term programs for wildlife disease surveillance, monitoring, and ecological research on disease and free-ranging wildlife within the United States. Instead, these activities are commonly transient responses to crisis events, with much of the leadership and resources associated with these events oriented to protect human and domestic animal health interests. Further, wildlife disease information gathering and dissemination is primarily ad hoc, often chaotic, and seldom incorporated within the mainstream of social and administrative decision processes. Nevertheless, a wealth of information on wildlife disease exists, but it is not in general use. There is a great need for enhancing the integration of disease ecology within the mainstream of wildlife conservation activities and for greater programmatic approaches for embracing the concept of One Health that I noted before, for addressing infectious disease emergence. This need is driven by an increased interface between humans and other species that results from human-associated land use changes and their contributions to the urbanization of wildlife, and by human activities such as ecotourism and other factors, including the wildlife pet trade, which has already been mentioned in this conference. Disease transfer resulting from these interfaces constitutes an increasing challenge for the well-being of all, as many pathogens move freely from humans to animals, as well as vice versa. And from a conservation standpoint, we don't pay much attention to the vice versa. Among the many interfaces between humans and nature that are potential pathways for disease transfer, the following deserves special attention: freshwater resources, urbanization, and the declining intimacy of children and teenagers with nature are three important examples of disease emergence involving human connections with nature. All three of these issues have wildlife components that are inadequately considered within the context of human health. Wildlife-associated waterborne diseases and the health of those wildlife are closely linked. We see numerous waterborne-type diseases like tularemia in Europe following civil unrest and breakdown of water systems. Also, urbanization of society is accompanied by an increased importance of urban areas as wildlife habitat in ways that facilitate zoonotic disease transmission. Preemptive management rather than wildlife destruction is the solution for these waterborne diseases and the urban wildlife situations. Wildlife destruction is unacceptable for numerous reasons and often counterproductive, for many species are important economically, i.e. ecotourism. In many countries, much of their revenue comes from looking at wildlife, people traveling to Africa on photo safaris, etc., and also serves human health. For example, the recent dramatic decline in activities in nature among young children has been negatively associated with physical, emotional, and cognitive health issues, in addition to suppressed inventiveness and creativity. And I'm going to take just a minute to read a very short quote out of a statement that was made. This is testimony before the Interior and Environmental Subcommittee, February 27 of this year, by Richard Love. It's called Leave No Child Inside, and I'm just going to read you one short passage here. The back page of the October issue of San Francisco Magazine displays a vivid photograph of a small boy, eyes wide open with excitement and joy, leaping and running on a great expanse of California beach, storm clouds and towering waves behind him. A short article explains that the boy was hyperactive, he had been kicked out of his school, and his parents had not known what to do with him. But they had observed how nature engaged and soothed him. So for years, they took their son to beaches, forests, dunes, and rivers to let nature do its work. The photograph was taken in 1907. The boy was Ansel Adams. I'm sure you've heard of him. End of quote. Interactions with wildlife are an important component of this decline in nature activities. Clearly, we need to better understand the relationships between nature and health and how human connections influence both. If we wish to stem the flow of disease emergence, it is clear where to begin. We should start by heeding the words of Pogo, quote, "We have met the enemy, and he is us," end of quote. If we are the problem, then we also can be the solution. Part of the solution lies in empowering people to act by enhancing society's knowledge level and by stimulating preemptive consideration of potential disease implications within the mainstream of decision processes. Much of the information needed already exists. However, ready access to a broad range of sound information in understandable formats, and I underline understandable formats, and presentation levels needs further development. The sound bites of the media doesn't cut it. The translation of highly technical information into formats usable by non-specialists and linking that information to other relevant components are basic needs. A primary orientation for these linkages should be interactive relations between nature and human health. Further, the use of this information in community-based processes, including education programs, should be major format and accessibility considerations. And I'm going to leave it there so we have more time for questions at the end. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Christy Garrett from the University of Alaska, and she's been heavily involved with the putting in the health information aspect to the Arctic studies that have been happening as part of the Arctic Council, and this year especially as part of the International Polar Year, which we've heard about.
Library with the Health Sciences Department, and I manage a website called the Arctic Health website. There's some pamphlets around here, and it is a project that was created by the Arctic Council, and originally the concept was that it would be a website for linkages and data and publications about all kinds of research related to human health in the circumpolar Arctic region. They asked NLM to direct the project. NLM decided that it was going to be about Alaska Natives because they already had some programs about Asians and American Indians. And so it was that way for a little while until I came on to the project, and the International Polar Year was coming up about the same time, and we were going to be hosting the Arctic Human Health Initiative, which is also some pamphlets around, and we realized that we really wanted it to be circumpolar, and somehow we convinced the National Library of Medicine that since the Arctic Council really wanted it to be circumpolar, that we should be circumpolar, so now we're scrambling to fill our site with circumpolar information. Why I'm here is because the couple things. One is I became involved with GIS through some projects I did in my earlier careers, and so I'm trying to bring this into the work that we're doing, and so that kind of ties into what we're doing here. Doesn't want to work. That's okay. I can use this. It's fine. Let's see. Nope, that's not working either. Got it. No, don't got it. It's just being stubborn. This is the website in question. The major features of the website are eventually going to be a publication database that we are seeking to fill with every publication relating to human health, and that includes wildlife research because it relates to environmental health, Arctic biology, and we're trying to find all the gray literature. We're finding collections from researchers that have researched different things in the Arctic, and we're including their collections. We are also creating a research database that will have, that we want to link to in a geographical way, so people can tell where research has been done. This is a very difficult task. We do have search engines, but the research database is still very preliminary, because one of the themes of my presentation is collaboration. I'm out there seeking collaborations with different groups to get more of these publications, to get more of these research projects, because if you go to a search engine like CRISP, it's pretty difficult to find the projects that are Arctic-related unless you do a billion searches on every possible topic you can think of, because the projects are spread all over the United States. So we're trying to get with groups that we know are doing those types of research. And it's becoming more interesting because these groups aren't just in Fairbanks or Anchorage or Norway or Russia. They're in villages and native corporations, and as we saw today, and there's nonprofits that are working with native corporations, and it's just starting to be a very interactive kind of system. As I talked about, the Arctic Human Health Initiative is running at the same time. It's part of the International Polar Year, and it's the first time human health is being part of that system. So we are going to be taking the research products from the Arctic Human Health Initiative, putting them in our database, and also mapping them as part of a geographical system. Let's see. One of the other things that we're really heavily working on is, again, the collaboration between not just human health, but how the environment affects human health. So a lot of our site and the Arctic Human Health Initiative are involved with environmental health. As you see, this is from a collection of a nutritionist that worked in the, I think, Norton Sound area during the 50s and 60s. And she researched the nutritional values and components of different native foods that included plants and animals, and we're trying to seek out that type of information, those type of studies that are from the past, and that information is everywhere. It is in archives, it is in libraries, it's in people's basements. That's where this came from, and that's part of our challenge. These are some of the groups that we're working with, the collaborations, the International Arctic Research Center, which is primarily a climate research group. We are seeking collaborations with groups like this because this climate research, of course, affects the environmental health issues. The ACAT is the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and they are an environmental group that has become very active in obtaining grants to work with Native communities on environmental issues. When Milt was talking about the research that's not being done into what animals, their health, one of their projects that they're about to start, or they may have already started, is in a few of the villages, is the villagers are being trained to measure different levels of toxins in caribou, in fish, in plants, and do this on a continuous basis to get a timeline. So there are some interesting projects, and we want to have access to that information too. Now, some of you may know that human health databases have some problems in the sense that data is tied to people, and people, that makes it confidential. In Alaska and the circumpolar north, where the communities are small, that is even more crucial because you can't take the names out and assume that people won't know who those people are. If you have a community of 50 people, one of the things that happened in Alaska not too long ago was there was somebody who had AIDS in one of the villages, and it was a small village. And they didn't release the name, but it was part of the public health surveillance list. Everybody knew. Everybody knew who it was. Everybody knew the name. It was public knowledge as soon as it went on to that public surveillance. So those are the kind of issues we have to deal with. The other issue is not just the legalities, but now the communities themselves are starting to want their research to be proprietary because in the past they have not been treated well. This is good and bad. Bad because it makes it harder for us to get the information. Good because it forces us to work with them better. It's something obviously we should have been doing all along. We should have been treating them better. This wouldn't have happened, but we didn't. We would come in and we would swoop down, take the information and leave, and they never knew what happened. And they want to know what happened with their information. They want to know what the results were, and that's a good thing. An example of a group that's doing this well and one we're trying to collaborate with is the Institute of Arctic Biology, and they study not just human health issues but wildlife and plant issues. And they are working with the local villages, and they are giving them lots of leeway and making them very much part of the process. And those are collaborations that will get us the information back into these databases. Now, then what we want to do is make sure that our information comes to our databases, because we are sponsored by the Arctic Council, by the National Library of Medicine. What you find, I'm sure all of you have had this experience, is there's this great information, these data sets, there's these reports, and they're up on the web and you can read them, and then the site goes away, or they take those publications off, or that research data disappears. We want to be the site where it is deposited, where we've got tons of computer space. We have a supercomputer. We have a way of storing it and make sure it stays in one place, and so our goal is to create a place where that information can go. I just put this up here because I used to work here, and the university, because of politics, that institute's may go away, and already I've seen a lot of their publications are gone. So that information will, however, we have it in our database, so it's not gone. It's some place where people can get to it easily. I'm going to finish with what our future is. Obviously, we're still going to be building the collaborations and the database and the publications, but we have found, when I was at the last conference I was at, I found this program called RMAP, which is an ESRI-sponsored program working with I can't remember who it is. Somebody, one of the universities. And it is specifically the Arctic research mapping. And we want to be part of this, too, because we want our information on there. And what this will do is it allows you to search out research on specific areas and in the circumpolar region in certain places. And you can drill it down to the point where you can see what the projects are. The interaction between climate change, water resources, and humans in the Arctic, that Arctic biology program, this is one of their projects. And it's those little dots at the bottom there. So that's where we're going in the future, and that's how we feel that this affects us as far as the digital Earth system goes. So that's my presentation.
We are done. Oops. Our next speaker is a nice transition here, ending with ESRI technology, because our next speaker is Bill Davenhall, who is the global manager for ESRI for Health and Human Services. And he's going to talk about how geospatial data can be used in medicine.
Thank you, Joan. My mother always used to tell me I'd behave better when I had a coat and tie on. So it tells you I'm only going to be half as good as I could be. First of all, I'd just like to say this is meant to be like an apology. I'm actually honored to be here and honored to be in presence of the people that are in this room that write books and do the science behind what I'm going to talk about today. If it wasn't for their work, a lot of the meaning of a tool like GIS is kind of worthless. So I say that from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much for writing these books and keeping people like myself inspired. I never aspired to be a scientist. I started off that way, but I decided I wanted to be an evangelist. And I don't mean like a religious evangelist, but I wanted to help people and help them mobilize their good ideas. So part of the reason I always feel I have a reason to be here, part of it is to walk away with some energy of how I can do something to help sort of move you where you're stuck. How can we help as a technology? So that's what I'd like to really spend my time on. I really had fun doing this presentation, and I hope it will be of some value to you as soon as I figure out how to get it up here. Again, I would also apologize with the logos in the corners. This just happens to be the framework in which I've done 1,000 PowerPoint slides. So it was just easier to keep all my slides. If you ever had to change the colors in the background of a slide set, you know what I'm talking about. So I sort of keep it in this mode. This is a little bit about me. I've been at ESRI 10 years. I'm not a GIS person. I don't even know how to use our latest products. I think they'd like it that way. But I certainly know how to talk about it, and I know how to talk about the work that people do with this technology. My actual form of training was a sociologist with a master's degree in medical behavioral science, which at the time I went to school was a relatively new science. There were only two programs in the country that did this. And the whole goal was to teach physicians about the social sciences and to start to bring that into their curriculum. I've been employed most of my life in some way, either for hospitals, public health, nonprofit research firms, organizations like social service agencies. So I have more than 30 years, but I won't tell you how many. It's because people tell me I look a lot younger than I actually am. And I talk a lot about this subject. So unlike the walker this morning, okay, my wife would agree with him totally, John. She'd like to have a couple good years where I say nothing. She'd be terribly happy. Now, you've seen these images before, but I sort of want to bring this into context. You know, we talk about all these layers, and I always say to audiences, everybody in this room has some proprietary interest in one of these layers. Some people have made each one of these layers their career. You know, if you talk about, USGS, you know, I could go down and name people who look at certain levels, particularly down here when we think of the classical sense of GIS. We use the word geography, right? Well, I've been with ESRI 10 years, and I struggle with geography. Most of my audiences look at me and say, what does that have to do with what I do? Right, because it has very little to do with geography. At least that's the beginning. Most people don't think that, you know, they've never envisioned that this is a technology that can be used inside a building. You know, what a wonderful thought. So what is medicine? Medicine is this huge. I mean, think about our greatest medical centers in the world. They're campuses, and they have, 4 or 5 million square feet of building undercover. And they need to keep track of the assets, just like a mini community. And so you begin to see all these things that if you're in the health field and you work, for example, in a hospital, you see the relevance of these things geospatially. And then lastly, which is my favorite, is that this thing has to do something for me. If I don't get any value out of coming to this conference, I'd have to conclude that there's nothing in this for me. It really doesn't help me in some way. It may help the greater good, but at the end of the week, the day, the month, I need to have my life changed in some way. So, you know, all this really can come down to, okay, so we have a map here of the human body. So these are actually real applications which people are beginning to find in medicine that, gosh, this is all related. That bodily system, that ICD-9 code, that one little, part of the human body in some way is integratable all the way back to the wildlife that Milton talked about, to the earth, the sun, the sky, the water, you name it, right? It's all interconnected. But this is a very difficult concept for people who don't think like this. So when I walk into a social science group, they struggle with this for about 20 minutes. That maybe seems like a long time. But they struggle with it because this has not been their analytical framework. Now, the thing that I love about GIS is this next thing. I want to be able to see it all. And in health, this is what I'm talking about, population health, health demographics. But then I also want to see what it is in my community. I want to see where it is in my space, you know, how it impacts me. And so the beauty of this great tool is this ability for us to move back and forth between this, you know, ever more seamlessly. You know, every year that goes by, I see greater opportunities for this seamless exchange of scale. So when Google Earth showed up on the planet, I mean, I said, man, this is great. I can go from here to the globe and come back. I can go visit friends and relatives all over the world. It's a great tool to help people understand the scope of the planet. Now, I want to define what I mean by medical digital intelligence, because just having digital health for me isn't going to be enough, and it's not going to be for you either. We hear a lot of talk here about electronic health records. And so I'm going to try to just say a few words to you today that would make you think about what value an electronic health record would have to you. And I'm not either for or against it. I just put it into context. Now, I could talk about global health. There's a thing called community or national health. There's a thing called family health or household health. And then there's a thing called personal or individual health. So where I'm going to go today is the yellow. I want to talk about how all this has something to do with my personal health and individual health. So this is what my world looks like to me, right? I work in three sectors. I exist in three sectors. I'm either playing, working, or resting. Is that true with most of you? Okay. So first of all, I work 3,000 hours a year. Now, how do I know that? Because we have a payroll system that keeps track of that, and we have to record our time. So I actually know how many hours I work for Mr. Jack Dangerman, 3,000 hours. I spend 30% of my time in an airplane, okay? And I like 747s, but it's usually in an airplane. I spend 30% of my time in the office. So you know I'm not really fast at answering email. And then 40% of my time I'm in some other place, usually outside of the U.S., but in some other city or some other locality or some other nation or household, you name it, right? Now, I spend 2,200 hours at rest. You know, I know about how many hours of sleep I need a day, and I can multiply that out. You should be doing this for yourself, because I think it's a useful exercise. Now, 15% of those hours I'm away from my bed, my home bed, but 85% of it I'm at home. Now, when I get to play, actually, this I love this, how it comes out. I play more than I work or rest, theoretically. You know, sometimes to a person like me, playing with my email on a weekend alongside my swimming pool in Southern California, I don't think this is work. My wife says it's really work. But I spend 3,500 hours of that. 30% is away from home, 70% at home. Now, what I'm trying to do for you is say this whole concept about e-health or health or digital health is complex. It is not simple. Are you already beginning to think of where I'm going next with this? So when somebody says to me, Bill, we're concerned about the health of your community, what is Bill thinking? Where's my community? Where is it? You know, after last week, I'm outraged now. I mean, I asked the passenger coming from Washington to San Francisco. He coughed three times. I turned to him. I said, excuse me, but you have TB. I said, I would have been embarrassed to ask you that, you know, a month ago. I'm not a bit embarrassed today to ask you. And he said, no. Leftover from a cold. I said, well, thank you. I would do the same for you now, right? It's going to change that, okay? So I spend a lot of time. Well, where I'm going with this is, okay, so I want to talk about place histories. Now, what is a place history to you? You know, it's where you spent, if you saw my last slide, those are the places that I spend my life. Well, in this particular case, this is my geographical place history. Right? Does anybody know where any of those are? Have you ever been to Scranton, Pennsylvania? Okay. And what I've listed is how many years I lived there and what I knew from just, you know, just the rudimentary reading the newspaper, what I was faced with. Okay, does anybody know what column is? A column pile? Ever heard of a column pile? What's a column pile? Yeah, and it catches fire through spontaneous combustion and it puts out methane gas. Now, as a kid, I thought this was great. My dad would take me to these big, huge blue mountains burning, putting off methane gas. The whole community breathed this, you know? And just think about it. When aluminum siding came, it came in white. the whole city of Scranton, like after one rainstorm, it was all yellow. And people wondered, what's going on here? You know, it turned to aluminum siding. And we just, you know, went on our way saying, oh, isn't that cute? So I sort of listed here the years in red are what I would consider places where my health was compromised. And green is, I think, okay. My years in, you know, Clark Summit and Owensboro. And look at there, Lexington. I was right down the road from the Bluegrass Army Depot, who had a nerve gas depot there. And I guess they still have it. It's a big, major environmental issue. Anyway, the point I'm trying to say is that when we talk about this thing of digital health, it's not in one place. It moves with you. So where you are really has a lot to do with what's going to happen to you, maybe what the diagnosis you're going to get. So this was an interesting exercise to do, and I would encourage you to do it. Now, this is what I learned. 70% of my hours are in my own community, so that's pretty good. But I'm also worried about the 30% that are not. And look at there, 67% of my years have been spent in compromised environments. All right? So here's the next conclusion. Okay? My geographically relevant medical personal health history is leading down a path to three big things. Now, how do I know that? Because I went to ToxTown and ToxMap. If you haven't been to those sites, they're excellent little learning tools about learning what's behind all this, what kind of evidence exists for the relationships to certain things. And I'm thoroughly convinced now that any problems I have with these three things in my life are going to be related to the place, my places. Fundamentally, that's where we have to get to, in my opinion, to move people forward. Because in many ways, health is already ready. It's been ready for about 20 years, that I would say, struggling for 30, but 25 years it's ready. We've had an international classification of disease. We don't have to have any more data models here. It's been done. HL7, there's no excuse for doctors not communicating with pharmacies, communicating with hospitals. I've been there. I've sat through hundreds of meetings and discussions of this. Tens of hundreds of millions of dollars of government money spending trying to get regional health organizations put together. I just conclude from all this is I probably don't have enough good years left to see an electronic health record anywhere in the world. And this just is in the United States. It's all over. So there's some other problem that we have to solve. Now, here's what I say is obvious to me. Now, I'm not a scientist here, so just give me a break. But I'm saying what is obvious to me is that we've got the data. It's poorly organized. It's not in systems. So we do have a lot of data, and a lot of it's digital, but it's just simply not been organized. There's not much content management going on with this data. You know, we still collect massive amounts of data and do absolutely nothing with it. And there's no excuse. I mean, this isn't like privacy. It's within the organizations that collect it. Public health agencies, the CDC, you name it. These people are sitting on mountains of data. NIH, $28 billion a year budget. And most of that budget gets spent in paying academic communities to generate data. Interesting, isn't it? So I say, you know, what's the problem here? We have enough evidence. If you're not convinced of that, go to Milton's book and read through his book that he wrote when he was USGS. I mean, it's painful to read this because it really suggests we have enough evidence to get going. We don't need any more evidence to sit around and wait to hook this stuff up. Data access is still, it's a social issue. It needs to be what we call in marketing socialized. I don't mean socialized from a political point of view. It needs to be talked among the people that have the ability to share it. You can't share data easily with someone you don't know. So if you don't know the person whose data you want, that's the first barrier you have to climb. And health naturally doesn't have a data sharing culture. They basically say it's mine, it's all mine, and you can't have it, and then they start using this new thing called HIPAA to keep you away from that data. And then lastly, which is not unimportant, is the clinical community is not convinced. Know what I mean? So try to get a doctor to try. When was the last time a doctor asked you about your place history? Asked you where you lived and how long you lived there? Would anybody in this room know what it would mean if I told you that I was born in Buffalo, New York, and my address was Love Canal? Would it mean anything to anybody in this room? Well, some of you are shaking your heads and some of you aren't. If the people who don't know what I'm talking about are physicians in some other part of the world, they're going to have no clue as to what that means. So the first test you ought to give me if the data was all, you know, organized and assembled and right before my very eyes, I'd give you a thyroid test. That's where I would start. Because the evidence is all over the place that they still have tremendous problems with thyroid issues in Buffalo, New York. I won't go into why, but you can research that yourself. So here's what I want to do. I want to lift up a couple applications because this is what I think we need to be more about. First of all, this is an application that came from the San Diego Department of Health and Human Services, a combined public health and social services, where essentially they said, we don't know what's going on in our community. Somewhat similar to some of the sites we saw this morning. We're saying, there's 60,000 organizations that somebody has counted that are working in HIV/AIDS. Now I would say, you could probably say you know a couple hundred, but you can't know 1,000. What are these people doing? Where are they doing it? And are they effective in doing it? So somehow this technology is going to allow us to put, as I call, more dots on the map. But we have to find a more organized way that people go look at it. Situational awareness. We no longer want to wait for our research. Isn't that amazing? Federal government came from Washington this week. I was told by people at NIH that they want to compress the time frame. They want the results of the research, even research in progress, to go out into the world faster. They're not wanting to wait years to get the results of some research. And it's going to put pressure on the academic committee like you've never seen to not just produce the results at the end, but interim reports. We're talking about websites that are maybe every day putting out new results that you're finding. It's a tremendous urge, and it's just not in the United States. It's all over the world. So wanting to know what's going on in our communities is going to be really important. This one on syndromic surveillance is actually in Houston, Texas, where they've actually built this novel little dashboard, and it's looking at complaints, symptoms, signs and symptoms out of the emergency rooms out of 92 hospitals in the Houston area. So there is, you can see in this one, this is the diarrheal one. And it's going up to yellow. So that's the only dial that's sort of out of place. Well, that data is coming from emergency rooms that people are walking in. They may have a problem in Houston with something in the water supply that's creating all that gastrointestinal. Okay, so here's my action items. What is needed? I think we need better organization of the scientific body of evidence that geography is relevant to human health. I've made this a passion for the last 5 or 6 years as I prepare for talks all over the world, and this is the one thing that I really need desperate help at. While many people have done all over the world excellent research in this area, it's not well organized. So I troop around the world, and I keep meeting people that don't know other people who are doing the same exact research and are making similar discoveries. They're not aware of each other. So I'm struggling to try to find a better way, and I think it needs some academic research help to figure out what are some of those barriers to that. We need to create a taxonomy for managing consumer health information searching. So as an exercise in preparing for this speech, I tried that whole thing. I mean, you saw where I said, I'm going to have cardiovascular, I'm going to have pulmonary, and I'm going to have central nervous system issues. So I tried to use all the resources that I know to go get information on all those. I looked up column piles. I looked at polyvinyl chloride. You know, I looked at all those chemicals I have there, the perchlorate that I'm drinking now in Southern California. And you'll suddenly realize what I'm talking about. No research community has stood back from it and says, how would the ordinary citizen in the world go find this? If they didn't know much about it, how would they even start? How would they know what really the hazards that exist in their community related to their own personal health situation? The other thing is, I think we need some specialized, what I call them, e-portals or e-globes that organize and consolidate. And I think I saw some of those. Yours, Christy, is one example, okay, where people are beginning to specialize in this area. So if I want to know something about Arctic health, I'm thinking I got the words Arctic and I got the word health. I go to that one place and I might learn a comprehensive array of things that are being done in Arctic health. You could start to do this in malaria. You could pick every disease you want and create a portal for it. It sounds like a lot of hard work, but in this day of technology, it's pretty easy. So rather than this thing where we put it all together in one place, I'm suggesting we think of a much wider distributed, widely, not only geographically distributed, but virtually distributed, but build the communities virtually. And then the last thing is to accelerate this virtual networking. We need to find better ways to take what's authored, what the research scientists do, and get it out there. I mean, translate it, make it relevant. Okay, so this is my last slide. So here's what I'm saying is going to happen by 2015. I actually had 2010 there, but last night I changed it, you know, because after I watched Larry King in the TV thing, I said, I think I better give myself 5 more years here. Okay? Anybody watch any of that coverage? It's pretty scary. Okay. And you'll realize it's not a technology issue. It's a socio-culture issue, probably at work, and we're all going to have to face it. You will update your place history before every physician visit. You'll be required by a physician in the future. I have evidence to tell you that that's going to happen because I know where there's GIS programs now in medical schools. You can't get out of 4 medical schools I know in the world right now, but you can't get out with a medical degree unless you have a course in GIS. Your physician will automatically know if you're at risk for certain environmentally sensitive diseases. When you walk in and you fill out that basic registration information, they're going to immediately know what you're at risk for. How are they going to do that? Are you thinking about how that would actually occur? The data's all there. The technology's all there. Your public health department will send you a health alert warning of pediatric asthma risk when you purchase a house within 100 yards of a major freeway. Is the evidence there? Yeah, is the data systems available to do that? Can we identify where somebody lives? And I mean, we usually in healthcare, we wait till the person gets sick and they show up our door, and then we do the research and we say, well, people who live near expressways. I'm saying we already know the evidence now. Why don't we turn this upside down and say, well, let's go identify every household in which there's a child under 5 years of age, and let's go talk to them. And maybe we can encourage them to move. Better yet, maybe we can encourage our planners never to allow a house to be built within 300 feet of an expressway. Yeah, that might be an interesting thing. You'll be able to do a global search on a specific disease and get a site index with relevant links from promising clinical trials. Think about this now. There's people right now in the world that are doing clinical trials for the disease you have or a relative has. You just don't know how to find it, right? And you'll be more effective. You're going to find where you can go to afford these things. And lastly, the WHO will advise national health ministries of geographically specific health issues as the byproduct of consumer internet searching for health information, such as symptoms, treatments, adverse events, best practices, promising research. This is what Google is just fantastic about. Their search engine, think about this. When you go to the internet and you put in the word glaucoma, on any given day in the world, any day, time of the day, 24/7, Google can tell you how many times that word got put into a browser. Now, do you think that might be useful data for a group of health researchers? I think the answer is yes. Thank you.
What we're going to do is want to get through the last talk, and then we'll all be together and kind of do it as a group. So, and with that, I'll introduce our last speaker, Martin Ruzek, who is the head of Earth System Science Education for the University's Space Research Association, and he's going to speak about Earth System Science Education for Health and Sustainability. So it's kind of, in some way, sort of fits from the other aspect of the big picture of how we look at Earth System Science and health. Martin.
Thank you, Joan. Let's see if I can play with the technology here and get this. Help me here. I'm a Mac guy, so. Yeah, the PDF, right. And we do view as full screen, right. All right. Well, thanks again for the opportunity to be here. I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes or 13 minutes or so to help contribute a tiny thread to this tapestry we're weaving called Digital Earth. And the topic here is Earth System Science Education for Health and Sustainability. To be honest, it'll probably be mostly Earth System Science because that's what I've been doing. I'm a geologist by training. We've heard a little bit about Earth System Science, this idea mentioned tangentially, not so tangentially through this week, but I think I'm going to show that it's a great framework for considering all the things we can do with digital Earth, a framework for considering all the things that are happening on Earth, global change. I'm with University Space Research Association. We're a nonprofit of about 100 universities that does space research technology. Looking at the Earth from space is our connection to space, and of course, the Earth is a planet as well. So very quickly, I'll talk a little bit about what is Earth System Science, cut to the chase here, some considerations for Earth System Science education, how we apply it, some examples for health and sustainability, very simple examples I came up with. A little bit, if I have time, about the program that has funded all of this. For the past 15 years, I've been funded by NASA, who's funded this program in Earth System Science education at the undergraduate level. And then just a thought about where we're going in the future. And again, to cut to the chase, we're looking to go international. We're looking to do Earth System Science education in Asia specifically. And I'd love to talk to anybody who's interested in that. Well, here we are, the pale blue dot, the blue marble, the planet Earth from the moon, 1968. Every mountain ever climbed, every ocean ever navigated, every life ever lived happened here, where the astronaut could reach out with his hand and close off that blue planet. And it's a special place. And it's given us a new call to understand it better. Earth System Science is one of those ways. Here's a simple way to looking at the Earth system. And this might be in a third grade book. Air, water, land, life are all interrelated. It completely. There's no topic or theme anywhere on the planet that can be extracted from another topic or theme. It's integrative. It's interdisciplinary. And just like the ancient Greeks, we have life instead of fire, but the fire of life might be one way to think about it. But there's more to it than that, of course. The sun. We heard yesterday Bob Carrill talk about the sun's influence on climate change, less than 10%. But the sun is important. We're lucky we have a stable star. If that were not the case, we'd be in a very different situation. The cryosphere, the ice theme. International Polar Year is upon us. The next 2 years we'll be focusing on ice and how it modulates the Earth as a system. We can't ignore our place in the solar system and our solar system's position in the galaxy. On geologic time periods, every few hundred million years, our solar system migrates through spiral arms of the galaxy, giving us a vastly different environment as far as cosmic rays, as far as high-energy stars. The energy environment is completely different. So we have to, on the long scale, consider our place in the galaxy. And, of course, where the rubber meets the road is life, people. We wouldn't be here asking these questions if it weren't for people. And that's really applied Earth system science, how it affects us, impacts us, and Earth, and human health and sustainability. So over 15 years of this program funded by NASA, we've had a university community of about 60 or 62 universities involved. And these are some themes that we came up with. What is Earth System Science? And, of course, if you ask 100 people, you get 200 answers. But this is sort of the themes. It provides a physical basis for understanding how the Earth operates and upon which we live. And we realize Earth is an integrated system. Again, no parts disconnected from another part. And we intrinsically understand that, but historically education has been more and more compartmentalized. And while we're bringing things back together to understand the interactions. It's really relevant today because we now realize that we're changing our planet, so we're much more interested in how the Earth is changing. But also, the view from space has enabled a whole new range of ways to look at our Earth as a system. And that's my connection. It's been through NASA remote sensing. And, of course, we're seeking a deeper understanding. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And we can't just compartmentalize our knowledge as an Earth system. A little bit of history. NASA commissioned a report in the mid-1980s to define how it would look at the Earth from space in something called the Earth Observing System. This report was seminal in defining how NASA's Earth Observing System was defined and operated, something called the Bretherton Report. Key to the Bretherton Report, chaired by Francis Bretherton, is this wiring diagram. And you'll see atmospheric processes and biospheric processes and Earth solid Earth process is not quite as prominent. But you see just one small little part here, the human activities in one little box on the side. And again, that is actually quite a big part that we need to consider. In its full glory, the Bretherton diagram explodes in this way, which is still not the full complexity of fluxes and flows of processes in the system. But again, humanity, human impact is here in this small corner. The bottom line here is the Earth is a complicated place. Now, that small part in the corner can be blown up, social processes diagram. A few years after Bretherton, Ceeson came up with a document called Pathways to Understanding of Social Processes. And here's a similar wiring diagram, which is probably much updated by now, of the processes as people interact with the system. In this case, the global scale environmental processes are the small box. But again, this may be indeed the more complicated system because human processes, the social processes, are probably more nonlinear intrinsically than the physical processes on the planet. So we pulled those two diagrams together and created something we call the Earth System Pyramid understanding that Earth system science builds on the disciplines. We cannot understand the complex processes without fundamentally understanding the chemistry, the physics, the mathematics. Upon these disciplinary foundations, we build more and more integrative and interpretive disciplines of science, and we start moving into the realms of social sciences processes here with medicine, sociology, economics, human activities, more and more refined, building on the basis of the science, politics and religion, followed by global destiny. And it's really not a stretch to say the destiny of the humankind on the planet fundamentally depends on our understanding of the Earth system and how we interact with the Earth system. So this is one of the ways we consider Earth system science sort of as the base of this pyramid, moving up further and further depending on your specialty. Earth system science has several roots. I think of Earth system science as coming from the physical sciences. Environmental science shares much of the same information as Earth system science, but has its roots in life sciences, and I'd welcome discussion about this. This is my single-handed perception of how this works. Geography, of course, has similar concepts as Earth systems and environmental science, but also brings the social sciences into play. And these are the heritage. So digital Earth, of course, encompasses all of these things and is a tool that can serve all of these issues. And one other way to look at Earth system science, connecting global to the local. You can't understand the Amazon forest without looking at the big picture, and vice versa. You can't understand the big picture without understanding how land use on the ground. So it's another mechanism to examine the Earth system on all scales. We heard a little bit yesterday about education and processes of understanding STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. This is the big four that National Science Foundation and others are concerned about, especially in this country, STEM literacy. And what I'd like to propose is Earth system science is actually a very accessible, relevant, and compelling pathway to understanding STEM. If you want to get somebody engaged and interested in STEM topics, one of the pathways is Earth. It's accessible. You go outside. Earth system science is everywhere. You can look out any window and have an Earth system science lesson, even if you're locked somewhere in the city. It's relevant. It's affecting people now. Floods, hurricanes, fires, earthquakes. And it's compelling, of course, with global warming, with hurricanes, things like that. So, again, Earth system science, accessible, relevant, compelling. That's my mantra for the last year. Joan knows about that. So let me switch gears a little bit and now get to the sustainability in human health. I would contend, and I think many would agree, that Earth system sciences offers a framework for which to consider topics such as health and sustainability. And I'll give you three very brief examples of that. Cholera. I'm a geologist, so I don't know a lot of these things. Help me out if I get this wrong, Joan. The cholera has been a scourge on this planet for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. People didn't understand the mechanism for cholera. It would suddenly appear, and the epidemic would disappear. Here's the little critters that cause it. Their host is zooplankton, which feed on phytoplankton, which are driven by sea surface temperature. So here's a chart that shows incidence of cholera in Bangladesh as a function of sea surface temperature. And you see they track rather well. So before people understood this systems connection between sea surface temperature, phytoplankton concentrations, zooplankton concentrations, the Vibrio that produces the cholera, it was unclear why cholera epidemics would come and go. The systems approach helped understand that. Not to pick on Bangladesh, but we can again look at arsenic and wells in Bangladesh. In the early 70s, there was a big push to get fresh water into people's lives to avoid cholera, diphtheria, typhoid, diarrhea, things like that. Millions of wells were drilled between 20 meters and 200 meters deep. 15 years later, it was discovered these wells are seriously contaminated with naturally occurring arsenic in the groundwater. And now the problem is it's a new problem. There's arsenic poisoning on a massive scale with hundreds of millions of people, up to 100 million people who are consuming water from these contaminated wells. Again, a systems approach could help to have possibly diverted that if we had considered the whole picture, not just potable water. And another topic here is system and sustainability. Corn as a feedstock for ethanol production. It's been in the news lately. We can use corn to produce our own ethanol to get ourselves away from dependence upon foreign oil. Is this really a good idea? And I don't know if yes or no, but here's some things to consider. On a systems approach, The global consumption of grains has gone up. The global production of grains has not kept up with that. The world grain supply is actually diminishing. This amount of grain this summer is only enough to feed the world for 56 days. Apparently, it's at the lowest level since the early 1970s. Likely what's going to happen, the price of grain will soar. Will the production of ethanol from grain be economically feasible? And that's a completely different question than, is it sustainable from an energy point of view? How much energy you put in to produce the grain, the ethanol energy you get out of the grain? And again, USDA charts on consumption of corn for ethanol versus the corn exports. Again, a systems approach can help solve these problems, sustainability. And I'm not sure how I'm doing on time here. I'm probably
doing okay.
Let me jump to a little bit about the program that helped support all of this work. Earth System Science Education for the 21st Century, funded by NASA again for the last 15 years. We're on our last year of funding, quite literally. But what we've done in the last 15 years is reach 63 universities, several hundred faculty, probably over 100,000 students with courses, curricula, in some cases degree programs, in Earth System Science. So what the program was about is a collaborative undergraduate-graduate program crossing the disciplines, emphasizing understanding as the Earth system in the context of the individual university or college that offered the program. We, as USRA, offered small competitive grants to these universities. They write proposals, develop courses in Earth system topics, and then come together as a collaborative community to share the results of what they've learned and to jointly develop and share courses as well. It really was a systemic change in new thinking. 15 years ago, Earth system science was kind of wishy-washy, what's it all about? And nowadays, Earth system science is mainstream of NASA's science program as well as NSF's geosciences program. So really, it was part of the wave of reform in considering the Earth as a system. We've also reached minority-serving institutions in our last round. And again, we've got a current group of 18 universities that are just finishing out the program. And before that, we had another 45 universities. The goals of the program, to develop a community, which we've done. We've got probably several hundred people that we can tap into. We're seeking to grow that community. To develop content and share that content, and to provide an infrastructure for people to come together and do that. My kind of corny way of looking at it is community content and infrastructure are vines, fruit, and a trellis. If you think of the community as the green stuff, the vine, it's photosynthesizing federal dollars from research and growing. The fruits of their labor are the fruits on the vine, the actual graduate students, programs that they develop, courses that they develop, materials that they develop. And the infrastructure is what I provide. For 15 years, I've been building a trellis, basically, helping universities to share their content with each other, with other universities, and now we'd like to extend that trellis globally. ESSE's taught us that no department or program could do it alone. It's intrinsically interdisciplinary. So not one university, not one individual, not one department can cover the entire breadth of Earth system science, especially when we start approaching the social sciences. Again, our history is physical sciences. We know the geology and the oceanography and the atmospheric sciences, but we really need desperately help from the social sciences and where human interaction gets involved. Joining the faculty from the different disciplines is critical, and yet retaining the strength of the disciplines. We can't lose fact that we have to understand the physics, the chemistry, the underlying mathematics that defines it all. Again, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This is our participants over the last 15 years, and we have a happy group that meets when we have money to meet. Last time was 2 years ago. But really, everyone loves these meetings. It's a great way to get to know other members of the community who are like-minded. We have a special issue of the Journal of Geoscience Education. It came out last year. 30 papers focusing on Earth system science education at all levels. If you'd like a copy, let me know. I have a few here. We also have it's available online. Another product of the community, Earth system science education, has been something called the Design Guide for Undergraduate Earth System Science Education. We've distilled 15 years of our experience into a series of web pages, about 200 web pages that describe the science, the pedagogy, the networking, the capacity building of using Earth as a system in the classroom. And that will be available later this summer, but we do have a flashy brochure that describes it. Feel free to take one or several. They'll be floating around. And it will be online later this summer. But again, it's designed as a guide for faculty seeking to adopt Earth system in the classroom. These are the authors in the different sections. Joan was intrinsic in helping put the whole thing together as well. Developing external partnerships, the STEM pipeline, minority-serving institutions, and our closest connection to Digital Earth is Earth System Science Data Models and Tools, where Digital Earth is, if not explicitly, implicitly part of that section. We've got resources on education vignettes and syllabi online. This is a front splash page. And finally, just a seed for your thoughts of the future, again, we're on the final phases of NASA funding, but I'd really like, and we've got a group of folks very excited about moving this internationally. And we're especially interested in working with Asia, with China. I have connections there, as well as Southeast Asia, India, and Russia. So if you have any connections or ideas there, I'd love to talk to you about that. Building on the design guide as a contribution, seeking funding from private sources, not government sources, that would be interested in sharing information within Asia, as well as working with American educators and universities. And again, looking for networks. So thank you very much, and appreciate your time and attention, and glad for being here.
I'd like to invite all of the speakers. We'll sit up here, and we'll have a general question, at least for a little bit. We'll run a little bit over. And while folks are coming up, I want to just mention and thank Sam Walker, my co-chair, who's been taking notes, and the plan is for Sam and me to write a paper about the session so that there'll be sort of something in writing and submit it to the journal, that the new society journal that for Digital Earth that's been created.
My comments weren't meant to exclude that, but my feeling is those assessments already exist. In other words, if you go to a doctor now, it's likely you're going to give them a drug history, you're going to give them a family history, and you're going to give them a personal history of behaviors, health behaviors, you know, through some sort of questionnaire that they did. The one thing that's never on the questionnaire is all the places you've lived and how long you've lived there. I mean, in all fairness to a physician, they don't know what to do with that if they had it today. So there has to be a lot of education of the fact that what lies behind that geographical place are, you know, billions of dollars of research, health research, that show connections between environment, place, and their own personal life.
Yeah, I don't want to play that important point down. I just want to mention, I see the difficulty of educating the public, of not jumping to a conclusion, of making an association with a place when there may not be one. An association with a place and a disease may not be a cause-effect relationship. That's what we struggle with in the scientific community.
I know.
That not every place is associated.
I mean, I drink rocket fuel every day, I mean, that I'm home. Okay, and my local government tries to downplay the importance of perchlorate in my water. And what I keep asking them is, can you tell me what I'm drinking out of this faucet today? And, you know, the real answer is they know. They have monitoring. They have well monitoring. They have flume monitoring underneath the sink. And part of this is getting access to that.
But access should be available.
Yeah, it's what I call controlled access. I mean, I'm not stupid. I know that, you know, public health departments aren't going to be allowed to sort of disassemble a community's economic activity. And I come from Louisville, Kentucky. You know what Louisville's noted for? The tobacco industry. That's where the guy, remember, stole all the documents and, you know, turned everybody in. And and was really part of the undermining of, the collapse, the house of cards fell, right? It destroyed hundreds of businesses in that community that had a self-interest in not wanting to be destroyed. So I always said my community had been in denial for years. Everybody knew it was bad. So when you live downstream from a polluting plant or you live downstream from a polyvinyl chloride factory, almost in spite of the research, there's almost an inherent, none of the rich people live under that footprint. All the poor people live under the pollutant footprint. But for example, in the thing you said, even the physicians in my community don't really understand the water table issue with perchlorate in our community. So even the physicians don't have access, immediate access. And I'm not sure if they just had access by itself. It's going to need somebody who manages this content for the purpose of human health. Right now it's being managed sort of as a quasi-environmental regulator, public health, which doesn't really get it. It's like CDC is collecting data from hospitals now. They're aggregating it to the zip code level, right? Well, it may be good on the national level, but it's certainly not going to be good enough for the Bay Area for an outbreak or something.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting, because it is data that is easier to work with, is the focus on contaminant-type situation. But your place of being also is shared with a large number of other species. And knowing the diseases of those species is instrumental to your understanding of health risks. So one of the major problems physicians face in this global society is that people travel all over the world. They partake in cultures that are unfamiliar to them in terms of eating foods. They get exposed to various kinds of organisms. And then they go back to their country with a disease that that physician has never seen in medical school, has no training whatsoever to be able to recognize, and that is not part of the history that gets conveyed. So it goes back to why I'm hung up on this stuff. If I might just to use a pragmatic example of how all of this stuff works together, and I'll go to where Christy lives. Right now, we have the issue of opening the oil reserves in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Okay? I'll bet you that in none of the discussion, none of the deliberation, none of the thought process in terms of opening that land is the issue of Brucella suis showed up on the table. Now, the relevance of Brucella suis is that it is a disease and enzootic in the reindeer there. Now, those reindeer are an international herd, caribou porcupine herd. They are the subsistence species for the natives, both in Canada and in this country. And the transmission potential of that disease, because it's a fairly unique situation there with deer flies, lust flies, transmitting. So how calving takes place on those grounds and what kind of disturbance factors become very important to the rate of transmission of Brucella suis in those reindeer. The significance to the wildlife, let's forget about the human disease directly, is that it is an abortion-causing disease. So here you have a situation that potentially can impact the food source, not just food, it's other aspects of the animals that are used for Native Americans, yeah, in terms of potential impacts on reducing herd numbers. Secondly, you have the direct human implication, yet none of this stuff is in the equations. No one thinks about this kind of integration.
That is. I also work for an environmental group in Alaska, And we were doing GIS, and our big thing, of course, was ANWR. And one of the things that they were doing at one point in time had to do with disease factors and abortions and how the... But they didn't have enough information because they were an environmental group, and they didn't really have somebody to work with them.
Yeah.
They didn't understand it completely.
Yeah. Well,
they knew it was there, but they couldn't map it effectively because they were missing a piece of it.
Yeah. Well, historically, before it's kind of wrong,
the
ability to go in there and study was squashed politically.
Right.
Okay, because I tried to go in there.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. That was what we were missing, was we knew it existed, but we didn't have anything to back it up.
But I only use it as an example of the kind of relationships we have to consider. And those relationships need to be considered within the communities that are going to be making these land use decisions. And I think it goes far beyond the environmental groups to be raising these things.
Well,
what I'm struggling with is how do we get those kind of relationships into the public knowledge? It's like was said today in a couple of presentations. You need to take your information and tell a good story. Well, what I'm searching for is how do we take the facts we know, translate it into a story that is meaningful in terms of people's lives so that they then want that information and will use it. And I think that's one of the failings we have. We had a ton of scientific information, and while it may turn us on as scientists and investigators, I can tell you, even though I've never really given up science as an administrator of a major program, I'm not interested in fighting through all the detail. I'll let Josh fight through the detail, and just give you the things that I need to work with.
Good question.
Yeah, I've come to it not from the tech point of view, but I'm an HIV journalist, and I work in very poor communities in Africa, and I've been looking at the tools like digital mapping, somewhat the way you were describing, in the middle, about what's in your environment, because my view is that these tools can be used by every individual if we flip it, and rather than having it be how can the tools focus on the individual, the actual approach is sort of the traditional structural approach to structural violence approach, like people like Paul Farmer talk about, in which you're thinking that you have overlapping. It's essentially what puts a disease in the path of a person, essentially, or overlapping diseases, whether it's malaria and AIDS, which are linked to poverty, which are linked to social conditions. So you have social and economic conditions, which are the environment that produce health conditions. So it's possible, I think, to orient it where any individual, whether it's you or I on any of these things, could be taught to essentially do a risk assessment of our own conditions in order to know what we are at risk for. And at the same time, the other piece of it that I think wasn't in your presentation but I think could be is once you do that, whether it's looking at where is there access or not access to water, or what is the local environment so that there's going to be more mosquitoes or there's possibly dengue or whatever it is, you can also then work with the kind of data you're talking about from the various health systems and hospitals in order to know who's making available the resources to address that. And I think that's the piece that's missing right now. So you can actually come out with a pretty cohesive. So I think that that we're a lot further along. I wouldn't put it in 2015 if we would approach health as simply a mirror for socioeconomic condition and realize that you can't, and I don't agree at all with the idea of having a portal for malaria and a portal for these things, because the problem is that you see huge overlaps and that people don't recognize you can come in and treat someone for HIV, but if you're not screening them for malaria and they get malaria, they're going to just have a regression of their HIV and progression, etc. That they're all overlapping, and that's the environmental approach that you're talking about when you're looking at reindeer or something, but you can actually do it with that kind of approach of risk reduction, not of behavior, human behavior, but of the economic and social conditions, and then I think all your data then can be applied. So I'm interested in the field going in that direction, and looking forward.
I actually believe with this technology, call it Digital Earth has to do is it has to get ahead of the disease.
Excuse me?
It has to get ahead of the disease. We have the capability to get ahead of most of these diseases. Let's pick on malaria. That's probably my favorite one to pick on. There are so many people doing research all over the world on malaria. They're not well connected. But everybody's into it. Now, why is everybody into malaria? It doesn't kill that many people. I can name 15 things that kill more people on the planet than malaria. So why do we keep studying malaria?
It's a chronic, debilitating disease.
Okay, well, but it still doesn't...
Economic impact.
Yeah. I guess what I'm still saying, it still doesn't kill that many people in the grand scheme of things. I mean, you could say that one life is worth it all, but I'm just saying... So my argument to myself is the reason why most people want to study malaria is there's certain kinds of known things about that. We know something about the vector. You know, it has something to do with rainfall and vegetation and people that get in the way of those things. So, you know, I'm on this decanal panel. Why they put it on me, Rita Colwell recommended me to a decanal panel on Earth observation. You know, this big refunding thing that's going on. And I was just scared to death. I mean, can you imagine with all the scientists in the room? I'm a marketing guy, right? Her argument for me was, she says, well, unfortunately, we need to have help from people who can translate all this to a message, because Congress doesn't want to hear. We want to put up another satellite with 10 more nice instruments on it and have all the academic communities fighting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can find the proper economic model to motivate politicians to deal with it.
What country is this in?
Well, certainly in the United States, I believe.
Well, what I was really trying to get at here is that my response to the lady in the back, the AIDS worker, is that, you know, part of this is doing the greatest good for the greatest many. And if we already have some of this evidence, read his book. I mean, when you're finished with his book, if you don't see the obvious connections to this, we just have to do some hard work at getting it put together. It may mean educating more universities to actually do applied research in this area.
I don't think it's hard work. And I think the Google situation stuff is there to do it. It's an issue. I mean, in Earth sensing, the issue is you got to have sensor data, right? Okay. What's the sensor data in this situation?
Well, it's
reports. I mean, when a doctor or clinic
there's so many possibilities, and I think my point is that rather than having it be, right now it's a top-down approach, trying to figure out what kind of information is going to be useful to this person. That's really backward, as opposed to going to the person and teaching the person how to assess your environment, and then from that you are able to determine.
Go. You all write down this site and go look at it. Whoisick.com. Who is sick? Have anybody gone to it lately? Yeah, what is this? Isn't this actually turning it upside down? The clinicians I talk to, the scientists, say it's worthless. I think they would be, that's kind of a self-serving comment in a way. It's saying, let's let the people tell us about how
that's
they feel.
That's fine as long as you can validate the data points and there's a model for that in project
right,
setting.
You're exactly
okay?
Right.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that there needs to be a standard taxonomy for tags. Okay, so they're searchable and findable inside of Google. As of last week, it is essential that anybody that's doing any kind of web page that wants to have geo-aware visibility inside of Yahoo, Microsoft, or whatever else, is you have to incorporate lat-long coordinates for it. Because what's going to happen, and what's already happening now, is that Google and everybody else, they go through and they map the entire semantic content of the Internet. After the primary team finishes with it, a week or two later, it's passed off to the Google Maps group. Okay, so they are now parsing everything that they collect, and if it has a lat-long coordinate in it, it's being passed over. Okay, so if you incorporate lat-long and you do disease-specific issues, you maybe put in some kind of level of authentication for the person that's putting the data in, whether it's an individual user, it's an institution, or whatever, then all that stuff would be parsable. And I think you could come to a generalized form of what you're talking about if you had a best practices standard.
See, you like the idea.
I think it can be done in under a year. I think, I honestly do.
Sounds like there are two different questions. Yeah. I mean, part of it's the technology per se, and I think the technology...
Well, you can do it in
the
coffee
human
shop.
It's the human systems that actually use the human systems to use, understand, and act on it. And I think that's where we have. And I think part of your question is, it's sort of the point I made with the article by Linder, which is that there are many different, there's these different levels of intervention, and they're all important. Some of them approach the individual, like the place history. Some of them are looking at the upstream determinants, which is, I think, part of what you were getting at, is that, you know, a certain poor community is going to be at risk for multiple things. And you were, instead of kind of separating it, well, so each perspective, it's a different perspective, and one should perhaps not do exclusively ones. They have these different entry points. You know, certainly the issue of poverty and inequality, I mean, it's been shown just in studies around the world that that is a major determinant of health, but that doesn't mean you don't look at specific diseases as well. So I think it part. So, but I don't think the technology is the limiting thing now.
It's not.
It's the educational issues. It's the use.
Well, it's an organizing. It's like a best practices. What are you going to do to put in place?
But that's really what one of the points that you were making as well, which is that the physicians understand. I mean, if you're talking physician education, that's not a, getting
it's not
the
true. I understand it's not a trivial task. But again, I would throw out a challenge issue that, you now have a dual receptor MRI device, which has increased the capabilities of that whole diagnostic imaging system. You're within 6 years of having pathogenic tags to use as an imaging device to actually see pathology. Okay. Somebody, some group, NIH, or somebody needs to sit and go, okay, what's our theoretical model? What's our best way to diagnose people in year 2015? All right, let's look at what the data model is that we need to have there, and now let's back up, build a prototype that people can see and validate, all right? And then the educational institutions can look at both those data points and start to synthesize how they have to project their job tasks over the next 10 or 15 years to get to that point out in the future. And then implement what you can do today with the tools and the pieces that are in place.
And build in, it's interesting, we're talking about like a lot of this environmental place aspect is in connection with, doing the ecosystem change in public health book that, this is said in jest, but there's a reality to it. They said that it would be, we'll do something about climate change, it'll be easier to do something about climate change than to add something else to the medical school curriculum.
People self-diagnose themselves.
Well, that's the thing.
Very good arguments against people doing self-diagnosis. I understand the technology is there, but there's a reason why the public health system in the world is set up the way it is. And you cannot do anything without political will, which I think is something we haven't talked about a whole lot. But you also cannot get your society into a position where people are running around saying, this is what I have, and the government should do things about it, or somebody should do things about it, because that's a very dangerous situation also. So there's a reason.
That's a worst case scenario. But when there's an absence, it is a worst case scenario. Tox map is a good case point here.
Everything's right about Tox map. I really like it. What's wrong with it? Well, they had no budget for advertising. I mean, the kind of thing that ought to be on billboards and it ought to be on the Super Bowl.
Okay, there's ways to fix that.
How do people in communities know about this?
There needs to be a best practices document. Right. Okay.
So what you have to do, though, is you have to change the funding streams at federal levels.
But that's exactly what I'm saying. You have to have the political will behind it, because whether people want to admit it or not, this is not something that's going to be funded at the private level.
And how do you do that? Unless you show people what an idealized model for it is and what they can achieve, right, and provide a conceptual.
But I think those things are taking place. I mean, I think those things are taking place.
I can't find it.
The process that you're describing takes place at CDC every day. I mean, it takes place at CDC every day.
It's not visible because
George Bush or whoever is president will not stand up there. No, but you should care, because that's who gets press time.
It's the responsibility of the staffers to make it happen, I think. But that's why it's not. Your question was, why is it not visible? That's why it's not visible, because those are the people that get press, and they're unwilling to stand behind it.
You also have to look at Congress. I mean, in terms of political will, right. If you take a look at NIH, you will see these huge budgets involving treatment, treatment, and cure and stuff.
Right.
The issue of environmental issues and prevention. Take NIEHS budget, the budget for environmental health sciences. Is minuscule compared to things, because you know what, people don't want to change what they do. They would much rather have smoke, they do whatever. There's the huge budgets in it.
Well, it's not just that. Part of the problem is you were talking about people self-diagnosing. When people start self-diagnosing, suddenly everybody's concerned about cancer, and so all the funds go to cancer, whether everybody has cancer or not. Or all the funds
Well, it goes wherever the drug companies want to do it by their advertising.
Well, but, I mean, what happens, though, is something becomes the popular thing.
Yeah, I know.
And
well,
so the funding goes someplace else.
Does anybody know the name Mary Woolley? Mary Woolley started an organization on behalf of a group of universities called Research America. And the whole goal, this was 25 years ago, I know it because I was in business, and they came to my office and asked for a contribution. Mary was begging. And what they wanted was they wanted to increase the NIH research budget, which would benefit university, actually academic health science center. And I would just ask you whether she was successful. Would you say she was successful in increasing the NIH budget for the treatment part and everything? She was tremendous. Now, what it was a concerted effort by the people who had the most to gain from this, or the most to lose, depending on how you look at it. And it wasn't a technology discussion. It was taking to Congress topics on cancer and these kinds of things. And you could argue there might have been other compelling issues, but I would say to you that the public health community just started one of these. So they brought Mary Woolley in, and they started a new group, and I think it's called Public Health Works. I think that's the name of it. And it's going to take a decade to do the same kind of effort with Congress as Mary Woolley did with NIH, because fundamentally, if you look at the roadmap that everybody comes out with today, I mean, it was actually conceived, 10 years ago. So, I mean,
I certainly pray that you're incorrect and that the technology allows the visibility of some of these things and that the public is more receptive to it and if they're provided a capacity to act,
Well, here's a self-serving question I would ask you. Are you all universities related in some way or funded in some way? Or, no, you're not?
I'm not.
How is the academic community going to survive if the business model changes for you guys? They draw money as nonprofit organizations from the federal government. What's going
to
happen?
Well, it's going to have to change. I mean, when you're up to the 60-70% overhead, I mean, there's very little money that's going to be left over for any research. So that model is going to have to change at some point.
I mean, just the whole G&A and overhead costing related to grants and stuff like that make it an implausible action for anybody that's trying to do anything creative.
So I keep arguing that technology could be one of the answers to this if you didn't have to spend all your money on it.
Well, that's why people do MySpaces. A lot of the researchers I know at NIH now, they're trying to get clauses in their contracts, they can put, their early research up on MySpace and start talking about it, and they're starting to get people interested in that way, and they generate more interest from, potentially private investors than they're going to get from their NIH once they pass their first round of grants, because, they're not doing anything different from companies who are looking at where are people. But I think that I'm not an academic. I spend a lot of time doing research on the internet. And I feel pretty confident that I can find what I want. If I can't find it, I know who can find it for me. And I think that the difference between now versus 5 years ago and 10 years ago is that the average consumer now has actually been empowered to be able to take charge of their health, whereas up until very recently, and still now, I can't, for example, yesterday there was somebody desperately trying to get an article, and I didn't have a subscription. I only had PubMed, I had some other things. I couldn't get that article for them. I had to go to the damn institution, call a guy to get just send it to me so that they can do some intervention on, a melanoma in the brain. That's the kind of problem we have. That the science.
Did anybody before last week know that Denver was the place to go if you had a drug-resistant strain of TB? I've been in business 30 years. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
anybody
well,
else
the hospital in Atlanta is equipped to deal with, you know.
The point is that people with the technology are embracing it faster than the academic community, and the academic community is freaked out because they're feeling that they can't keep as much control over the purity of the science, the purity, you know, in other words, what's the difference between the thing that I spent a lot of time getting quality for and real results in evidence-based medicine versus whatever somebody wants to throw up on the internet. That's a different debate.
That is a
people are motivated to go and find their information faster than you and I can keep track of it.
There needs to be, again, what I was saying, an authoritative methodology for tagging it so that if it's coming from a specific source, you can rank, you know, your...
At some level, it comes down to educating people, because once you educate consumers, you educate them to recognize they're being sold a lot of goods on the internet.
Well, but they need to be able to,
that's part of the
they need to be able to find it faster. Because even now, when you go to look for it, it's sort of a morass. And you need to be able to see that clear.
If I was to go to SDR TV, I'd get 1,000 pages, and it wouldn't be... I would figure out the 5 or 6
pages. Yeah, but it's kind of funny. Last night, I put in the words TV and hospital. And the first hit I got was this Denver hospital. I thought, oh, wow, were these people on the ball? And then I looked at the story, and what it was an AP story about TB in Denver Hospital. And I went like 20 pages deep before I even found a mention of this hospital in Denver as part of their website, you know, saying something about it. What I'm just saying is that this won't work very effectively for the masses. If you have to know this much about
there's
what you
more
have
coming.
To do to do it.
There's more coming.
Well, I'm not arguing there's not more coming. I mean, there's more stuff every hour that's coming on the internet.
Well, but it's reasonably close.
But I think that, to get at the point, I think that strand that I said on communication and education, I think that between your system, you know, raising your system science aspect, and one of the, we were, Martin and I were in the education session yesterday, and one of the points that was a good child made was that compared to GIS, he sees Digital Earth as much more of a, but really for the masses, kind of the literacy thing. So I think that there's multiple points into this. There's got to be a general literacy. I think that's got to be going on. But also I think in terms of specific, like environmental issues, I think the kind of community organization, I don't think, because of these complexities, and particularly you talk about the issue of the brucellosis, you know, this stuff, I love your book, but man, there's a lot of stuff there. It's very complex, and I don't think at the individual level that just every Joe on the street is going to be able to do it. But I think these kinds of NGOs are absolutely essential for kind of clustering, because then they can bring in expertise to help. That I think basically they're going to be a key part of this communication and education structure as well, particularly at the community level. I thought that the examples we saw this morning were just fabulous, and I think that's something where then they provide a sort of a brokering agent between the real grassroots and the scientific community. And I think you're going to need some of that. And I think the examples we saw this morning were, boy, the Yukon River thing. I mean, that was just tremendous.
There's lots of other groups like that. Environmentally speaking, it's not just snow change. An excellent grassroots group created by a native group, and it's starting to actually catch on circumpolar, and it, you know, they provide really quality information.
But they've got linkages with some professionals.
Yeah,
right?
They have people that. Yeah, I mean, and sites like ours, which since it's an NLM site, we have requirements about the kind of information we can have on our site. It has to be, you know, a good peer review type of information. Those are out there, but you're right. It's hard for an individual person off the street to know which of those sites. I mean, do you go to WebMD? Well, I've seen advertisements on WebMD. Is that really a reliable source?
Or the Chinese medicine site they're trying to purchase.
Oh, yeah.
Well, see, this is one of the things I'd like to say to you all. I mean, you all work for nonprofits. I'd like to see some of the NIH budget go to organizations that will take on the challenge of organizing these taxonomies and structuring this, because if you allow this to the private sector, they're going to go where their greatest opportunity is always going to be. In other words, you know, now I don't go to WebMD anymore. I just go to NIH, and I basically decided that I think these people are really scared of getting sued if they put something really bad up there.
Yeah.
That's sort of the attitude of, hey,
they very
right?
are.
But I'm saying they still, they're still funding a lot of what I call projects that aren't systems. Project this, project this, project. And even ToxMap and ToxLine and ToxTown aren't integrated. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, don't they get to that? Mm-hmm. But basically it's because of their parochial interest. They're in competition with USGS. I mean, I would have to tell you, 10 years ago, I got more value out of what USGS was doing in public health than the CDC. And, you know, there's competition between these agencies, you know, that exists. And I'm just saying, as a private sector...
But think about it. I mean, I see your point, but think about it. We have the same thing take place in the private sector, right? And there it's called health. And there it's called healthy competition. Now, why isn't it viewed the same way
in government,
or the academic sector? Because universities compete with each other as well.
And it can happen. It's extremely difficult.
There are certain things that, my view is, there are certain things for which the private sector model of competition works very well, but not everything, particularly these systemic. Well, one could get a whole debate about education. I mean, there's all sorts of issues. But I think we've got to wrap it up for now. And I really want to thank speakers, thank co-chair, and thank you for participating in a nice discussion. So. It's nice seeing you.